Lecture 18, Nubian Neighbors.
Now we've returned to the Nile Valley, but this time not to ancient Egypt, but further upstream, upstream of the first cataract, the traditional frontier, the southern frontier of ancient Egypt, to Nubia. The modern equivalent of Nubia is the Sudan. But Nubia, in Greek, means land of the blacks, not a word the ancient Egyptians used. They described Nubia as Taseti, the land of the bowmen, for reasons which we'll explore in a moment. Here, little-known African civilizations flourished, the subject of this lecture. The first part of this lecture describes the discoveries of Harvard University archaeologist George Reisner, who excavated spectacular royal cemeteries at the ancient city of Kerma in Lower Nubia in the early years of this century. We describe his reconstruction of a royal funeral and his excavations at other Nubian cemeteries. The second part of the lecture takes, like we did with the Andes, what Reisner found, and gives some account of what we know about Nubian civilization today. And finally, we take a look at the contribution which Nubia made to ancient Egyptian civilization. This may seem a little bit of a tangent, but it actually isn't, because the relationship between Egypt and Nubia was a very, very important facet, and often a little known facet, of ancient Egyptian civilization, and something of considerable historical importance when you look at the discovery of the ancient civilizations. As I said, the Nubians were known to the Egyptians as inhabitants of Taseti, the land of the bowmen. Why did they call it the land of the bowmen? For a very simple reason. For many centuries, Nubia supplied large numbers of mercenaries for the Egyptian armies. And the Nubians, whom the Egyptians often fought and raided, were expert lethal bowmen. And many of the mercenaries were bowmen, hence Taseti, the land of the bowmen. But Nubia, to the ancient Egyptians, was critical. It was a remote land beyond the frontiers of what they defined as the civilized world, which is bounded on each side by deserts, the desert of the Sahara by the Libyans, the nomads, and to the south by the Nubians, the blacks. It was an African land, but it was vitally important to the pharaohs because it was a critical source of raw materials, not only tropical products like elephant ivory and ebony, but also gold and semi-precious stones. And as we saw in an earlier lecture, gold was one of the staples of Egyptian power in the wider world. At first, the Old Kingdom pharaohs were content to raid Nubia and mount expeditions to feed off its lavish natural resources. But eventually, as we'll see, the Egyptians turned Nubia into a colony. But they didn't so do so before powerful African kingdoms had developed quite independently along the Nile, kingdoms that traded with the pharaohs. The Egyptians and successive pharaohs had constant trouble with the rebellious Nubians, who were cattle people with their own religious beliefs and social customs. These were not Egyptians. They had their own indigenous culture. Nubian chieftains, whose power was based and wealth was based not only on cattle but on their control of trade routes, were very skilled traders, soldiers, and entrepreneurs. When the pharaohs were weak, the Nubian chiefs became more active and challenged their authority. When the pharaohs were strong, Nubian civilization damped itself down a bit. There was this constant give and take between the two kingdoms. But to archaeologists, this area was little known until this century. It was assumed there were no particularly spectacular states there, although some people did visit the ancient ironworking kingdom of Meroe, close to modern-day Khartoum, which was an important caravan city about the time of Christ. But there were earlier states too, and thanks to remarkable archaeological discoveries at Kerma in modern-day Sudan, we now know a great deal more about tropical Africa's earliest indigenous kingdom than we did at the time when Napoleon was discovering Egypt, and even at the time when Tutankhamun was discovered. As I told you in the Hittite lecture, Leonard Woolley learnt much of his archaeology in the Sudan. The archaeology of Sudan was marked in the early years of this 20th century by the enormous numbers of cemeteries. And these cemetery excavations, which continued year after year, were an important training ground for Leonard Woolley, whom, as we will see, excavated the royal burials at Ur on the basis of his experience in Nubia. But the archaeologist who really put Nubia on the map was a Harvard University Egyptologist, George Andrew Reisner. He was one of the greatest Egyptologists of the 20th century. He was born in 1867, had a quite rigorous archaeological training at Harvard and elsewhere, and developed excavation methods during long digging campaigns which were far more rigorous than any of those of his predecessors, and indeed put Flinders Petrie's digs to shame. Even as a young man, Reisner achieved fame because of his excavations, partly because of his skill, but also because he excavated at a very conspicuous site in the area of the pyramids of Giza. But he made not only spectacular discoveries in Egypt, but he was the first serious excavator to work south of the first cataract. His more vigorous methods came from various directions. He obtained his degrees at Harvard University, which gave him an excellent basic training in classics and other fields, and in languages. He then studied Egyptology in Germany. By this time, the late 19th century, there were beginning to develop distinctive schools of Egyptology, one by the French, another by the British, and another by the Germans. And the Germans were particularly strong on art and excavation methods. Remember, the Germans had excavated the classical sites in the 1870s and developed new, more vigorous methods. And Reisner became a disciplined, careful archaeologist. He returned to the United States, and a turning point came in his career when he met a prominent, remarkable California philanthropist, Phoebe Hearst, who is famous for having founded, with her funds, the Department of Anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley, and the Berkeley University Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. In the early years of the 20th century, Hearst supported a long series of excavation campaigns under Reisner's leadership in Egypt and Nubia. She also supported excavations elsewhere, including in California. But Reisner's support was on a large scale. He delivered. He made distinguished finds in Egypt, including the excavation of many now famous nobles' tombs near the pyramids of Giza. Old kingdom nobles esteemed it a great privilege to be buried in the vicinity of the pyramids of their lord. And such tombs, richly painted, were an extremely fertile field for Reisner to excavate. From this, he achieved considerable fame. He also found, in perhaps his most important discovery in Egypt, the tomb of an old kingdom queen, Hetepheres, whose claim to fame was that she was the mother of the pharaoh Khufu who built the Great Pyramid of Giza. Said to be a despot, this was an important find of a name queen. Again, it put him on the map. But the Egyptian government, which was now very active in archaeology, was led by French archaeologists, decided in 1907 that it was time to make an archaeological survey of Nubia. And in 1907 to 1909, George Reisner recorded hundreds of sites south of the First Cataract, he being a sensible and logical person to lead this survey. And, among other discoveries, he located the cemeteries at the ancient Nubian capital, Kerma. What was Kerma? Kerma was an African capital. It was way upstream. It was upstream in the central Sudan, above the Nile's third cataract. As early as the 4th millennium BC, right back in the very earliest times of state formation along the Nile, it was a village, a cattle herding village. And then it eventually became a sprawling city, capital of the African kingdom of Kush, the land of Kush. Why did it become important? And why did it get bigger? Almost certainly, it is because Kerma straddled important trade routes from north to south along the river and into the desert. It became a funnel for gold, ivory, and slaves traded to Egypt downstream. Then, as now, the river was a highway. Now, the point which I made in earlier lectures is that none of the early civilizations were completely independent of the others. They were interdependent. And Egypt depended so heavily on the resources of Nubia, the mines, the ivory, all to support the prestige and wealth of the pharaoh, that this interdependence resonated up the Nile and inevitably affected the lives of the chiefs and people who lived there. Of nowhere was this truer than Kerma. By 1550 BC, we know that Kerma was a rich and powerful city, the largest in ancient Africa outside Egypt. Its ruler, whose name is unknown, lived in a fortified compound dominated by a huge mud-brick temple which owed much to Egyptian tradition. Now, in Reisner's day, Kerma was unexcavated. It was, in a sense, the center of a lost civilization. Now, Reisner came from a disciplined archaeological background, unlike his predecessors. He didn't just tunnel into the city. Like Flinders Petrie before him, he considered cemeteries the prime target for any excavation campaign, for one reason and one reason alone. They contained sealed grave lots of pottery, which, as we saw with Petrie at Nagada, provide really useful ways of developing chronologies, sequences of different pottery styles, changing fashions, in areas where there were no archaeological evidence for dating, no radiocarbon dating in those days, no other ways of establishing chronology like written records. So you had to use cemeteries. So accordingly, George Reisner concentrated on the vast Kerma Cemetery. And vast is the word. It's located about 2 miles east of the city, no less then 30,000 people, or even more, were buried there. But most of them were buried with very few possessions, a situation somewhat like that of the pre-dynastic Egyptians of Nagara. But, luckily for Wiesner, there were four exceptionally large royal burial mounds on the south side of the cemetery, each of them a staggering 250 feet across, each with their own mud brick shrine. Today, an archaeologist, say, digging the Lords of Sipan in Peru, is faced with an enormously slow-moving complex, series of seasons of excavation to decipher the full details of a royal burial. And at Sipan, the issues of conservation took almost as much time as the excavation, and it's a great triumph of Peruvian archaeology that they did it, and did it brilliantly. The scale at which Wiesner had to operate boggles the mind. Again, he could draw on dozens of unskilled and some semi-skilled laborers. It took him a long time and was very difficult, but in a brilliant feat of excavation and recording, he excavated these royal sepulchres and recovered the elaborate funeral rites. And this extremely spectacular excavation, which didn't yield great quantities of treasure, is one of the great unknown discoveries of the early civilizations. With meticulous care, he excavated the burial mound and reconstructed the funeral rites. Now, mentally, I want you to remember these funeral rites, because in a few lectures we're going to go to Ur and look at the way Leonard Woolley reconstructed the funeral rites of the royal kings of Ur. Here, the reconstruction is pretty reliable. Why? Because Wiesner's notes are reliable and good, and he wrote an excellent account of it. With Woolley's, we have Woolley's accounts, but we don't have his notes. So we have no idea of knowing how reconstruction is accurate or not. But Wiesner's reconstruction lives. It's vivid, just like Woolley's. He said that on the day of the funeral, dozens of the king's attendants, his harem and his children and their slaves, crowded into the burial chamber. The mourners took their places, intending to be buried alive. And they were. And this is how Wiesner describes it. The doors of the chambers are closed and sealed. The priests and officials withdraw. All cries and movements cease. The signal is given. The crowd of people assembled for the feasts at the side of the mound were waiting ready, cast the earth from their baskets on the still but living people on the floor. At that moment, we know from their attitudes to death that a rustle of fear passed through them, and that in some cases there was a spasm of physical energy, reconstructed from the attitudes of the skeletons. The mourners buried the victims alive alongside the dead ruler and then enjoyed a great feast of oxen at the side of the mound. Wiesner not only reconstructed the burial rites, but he found the remains of the feast and the hearths where families had eaten in groups on the plain nearby. Wiesner also excavated other cemeteries where he was able to reconstruct a historical sequence of Nubian cultures which spanned the same period of ancient Egyptian history. It was he who showed that the Nubians were cattle people, not so much farmers, although they farmed compared with the Egyptians, but they were also cattle people and traders. But they enjoyed, above all, a distinctively African culture. They were their own people. It wasn't until much later that Nubia became an Egyptian colony. But they maintained a loose but often rebellious ties with Egypt. The problem with Wiesner's work, and he excavated with great care, was that he was very slow to publish. And here again we come up with this age-old problem. publication. The great thing about Flinders Petrie was that he published everything he did. Reisner left enormous quantities of work unpublished. So really, in some respects, we are unable to measure the full impact of his extraordinary discoveries. But the royal tombs at Kerma rank among the great spectacular finds of the 20th century, but they were overshadowed in their day by the excavation of the tomb of Tutankhamun and the royal burials at Ur. But they show an African civilization at the height of its power, with its own personalized indigenous burial rites. Later excavations at Kerma have revealed the city itself. It covers more than 65 acres, with many outlying communities. When you have cattle, you tend to be dispersed because of the needs of grazing the cattle, and this settlement reflects this. In its heyday in the mid-second millennium BC, Kerma was so powerful that it traded not with the pharaohs in Thebes, but right down directly with the Hyksos kings of the Delta. At this time, Egypt was in political chaos. There had been extensive immigration of Asians and Asian kings into the Delta, and Egypt effectively had become two kingdoms. Lower Egypt on the Delta with the Hyksos, these kings were known as the Hyksos, and the rulers of Upper Egypt at Thebes. The Hyksos kings made direct diplomatic contact with Kerma. Such was the power of Kerma, and said, look, let us form an alliance and overthrow the rulers of Thebes. They communicated down remote desert roads. But we learn that some of the messengers were intercepted and the plot was aborted. But so powerful was Nubia that when Egypt was reunited by the new kingdom pharaohs based on Thebes, particularly the pharaoh Ahmose I, who came to the throne of Egypt in 1570 when Kerma was at its height, he and his successors waged war on Nubia. So strongly did they feel about the security of their supplies of gold and other supplies and control of trade routes that they actually conquered and garrisoned areas upstream of Nubia, of Kerma, to make sure that their trade routes were secure, and they built huge forts, which alas had been flooded by Lake Nasser. And these forts were ensuring tight control of trade routes and the former Nubian kingdom. Egypt had now made Nubia a colony. Kerma still flourished, but it was now more and more Egyptianized. Nubia, like Egypt, became a bit of an organized oasis, a place where agricultural production was controlled and where the sons and daughters of chieftains were thoroughly Egyptianized. And as long as Egypt itself was powerful, Nubia was a colony, and things were peaceful, and supplies flowed. But then after 1070 BC, Egypt became politically weaker, gold supplies dried up, and the pharaohs were shadows of their predecessors. And we get into this same old game from before, where when Egypt is strong, the Nubians lie low. When Egypt is weak, the Nubians reassert themselves. And as Egypt successively became a cockpit for conquest by outsiders and a shadow of its former self, the Nubians flourished at Kerma and upstream at Napata. But this time, they were thoroughly Egyptianized, and their culture had a very conservative view of Egyptian theology and of Egyptian custom. And in the 7th century BC, as Asian incursions and rebellions hit Egypt, the Nubian kings actually moved north and took over Egypt. And their Nubian dynasty ruled in the 7th century until they were overthrown by marauding Assyrians in 667 BC. And it's very interesting when you read the records of this Nubian incursion that really the whole coin has changed. Because the Nubian king who arrived, his name was Pianchi, endeared himself to the people of Thebes or Luxor by taking part in the great ceremony of the god Amun, Opet. He took part in the ceremonial procession, the annual procession of the god Amun from Karnak to Luxor, from between the two great temples, at which the power of the god and the pharaoh were revivified in ceremony, where the eternal verity of the rule of the sun god and of the pharaoh was reaffirmed. And by doing this, Pianchi not only appealed to the powerful interests of the priests of Amun, but the people realized that here was stability and continuity. Because ironically, the Nubians had become the conservative guardians of ancient Egyptian religion. They also became conservative guardians of ancient Egyptian art and did much to build art and temples and try to restore the old ways. It was a remarkable episode, which shows, which Reisner was the first to really demonstrate, that Nubia was no passive recipient of Egyptian influence. For years, Egyptologists assumed that Nubia was merely a land up there, which was exploited over many centuries by the pharaohs for gold and semi-precious stones. There's the famous story, of course, of the Pepi, the old kingdom pharaoh, who sent an expedition into the desert. He was a young man. And he heard rumors that it was returning with a dwarf. And there were messages urging people to look after this dwarf very carefully and deliver it to his court very, very quickly. The point being that this kind of influenced people to think that Nubia was sort of a foreign land where the Egyptians exploited it, fought it, and grabbed the raw materials. That is perfectly true. They did indeed exploit Nubia. It's been described as one Nubius as a sort of game park for the pharaohs, where they hunted people and killed them. But in fact, the relationship, as Reisner and others have shown, was extremely complex. And it was a two-way street, like all relationships. And Kerma and the rulers who were buried there formed the first powerful and dynamic African civilization, the first of many that were to follow in later centuries further south in the Sahara. And it's very safe to say that without a secure, reliable source of supplies from Nubia, and indeed in later centuries without the mercenaries from Nubian armies, ancient Egypt would have perished on the vine very much earlier than it did otherwise, because, among other things, it was the primary source of Nile's, of Egypt's gold. And as I told you in an even earlier lecture, gold was really the primary currency, not only of pharaonic power, but of Egyptian diplomatic clout. And it's been estimated by one expert that by the end of the New Kingdom, in about 1000 BC, gold was running short, inflation was rife, and that in fact there was more gold underground in Egypt than there was above the surface. And it's small wonder that an epidemic of grave robbing, especially in the royal tombs and in noble cemeteries, hit Egypt in the 11th century BC. And part of this was because the pharaohs were weaker and the Nubians were reasserting themselves, and the pattern of trade, which was maintained through colonies and earlier over thousands of years, was disrupted. The greatness of Reisner was that he showed that Egypt had a relationship with others. And with the South, he also showed that in Africa, there were distinctive African civilizations which were quite capable of holding their own with the Egyptians and taking advantage of the political station up north, which they always kept a pulse on. The Nubians were feared. The Nubians were considered animals. But above all, ultimately, the Nubians were respected. In one of the delicious ironies of history, they were the last pharaohs to maintain the conservative, traditional ways of the sun god Amun. And for that, they achieve a historical immortality.